Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. In this episode, we're investigating the story that the Gospels tell us, the story of Jesus, and we're particularly investigating the missing or lost years of Jesus, as requested by our client, Ichabod. Here he is.
Hi, God's Gumshoe. It's me, Ichabod. I have another question. What do they mean when they refer to the silent years of Jesus? What were they, and what did he do? I'm really enjoying the series. Thanks, Gumshoe. Keep up the good work. Ichabod.
Great. Thank you, Ichabod. Let's review the situation. Have a listen to this.
It is one of the world's great mysteries, a biblical conundrum that has baffled scholars for years. Between the ages of 12 and 30, the life of Jesus Christ is unaccounted for. There is no written record. There are no tales told.
Nature abhors a vacuum, and so do many religious folks. And that's why many people have talked about these missing years and have tried to speculate about what Jesus might have done during that time.
In modern times, attempts have been made to fill in the missing years. Wild stories of Jesus traveling to India to study with Eastern mystics. Even Jesus appearing in North America.
Any good historian who's worth his salt will go with the earliest and best evidence. Not later evidence, not wonky evidence, not evidence that contradicts all our earliest and best sources. You're going to go with your earliest and best evidence. And that happens to be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
From historical research and recent archaeological work in Galilee in particular, combined with things that we can deduce from the Gospels themselves, we actually know a fair amount.
Bethlehem is where Christ was born, but the Gospels say his family left soon thereafter.
He went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene.
This was not a party area. This was not a happening place. This was a kind of a quiet area in a lot of respects, a lot of farming that was going on, fishing that went on in the Sea of Galilee, and people that worked there didn't make a great deal of money typically.
The Gospels imply during the missing years, Jesus' status was blue-collar.
Once in the New Testament, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus' critics in his hometown ask, "Is not this the carpenter?" And then in the parallel text in Matthew, they ask, "Is not this the carpenter's son?"
There would not have been much work in Nazareth for Jesus, his father, or other craftsmen. Instead, it's believed Jesus could have found steady work 3 miles away in the bustling town of Sepphoris, known for its elaborate mosaic artwork created by the Romans.
You can envision the family spending many years building houses, building furniture, building halls, assembling buildings with limestone and wood. That's the family business.
The Nazareth region also provides clues to Jesus' level of education and his knowledge of the world. The language of the region was Aramaic, and scholars are certain that Jesus spoke it. The Gospels also say Jesus knew how to read, meaning he was educated during the missing years.
Apparently he knows how to read because he goes into the synagogue, according to Luke, and he reads from the scroll of the prophets.
He may not have been just a carpenter either. Because Nazareth was close to the Sea of Galilee, it's possible Jesus went there to fish. If he did, he most likely would have run into a group of fishermen, men who years later would lay down their nets and become his apostles.
As he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men."
It's written in the Gospels that Jesus had a father on earth named Joseph. He appears several times in the text, but disappears after Jesus teaches at the temple at age 12.
It makes sense to presume that at some point during this time he died, and that Jesus would have had to deal with the death of his father, and would have done the appropriate things as a son, namely attend to the burial services and attend to the various rituals, and then be especially attentive to his mother and the needs that his mother would have had.
But being the one responsible for his family would not last. There are clues in the Gospels that suggest Jesus would leave them behind. In order for Jesus' ministry to work, he would have to shun the people closest to him, his brothers and sisters, and his mother.
He went walkabout. He went out on tour. He went out to do miracles and signs and wonders and preach and teach all over the place, leaving James and the other members of the family to take over the family business. This, in a small town, would have been considered scandalous.
There is, of course, a great deal about those years that we don't know. But what we do know is not insignificant. And that is that Jesus grew up as a boy in the synagogue, learning Scripture, drinking deeply from the wells of Scripture, experiencing firsthand the social and economic oppression of the Palestinian Jewish peasantry of his time, of which he was a part, and envisioning a day, as he would later say, of a kingdom of God where the cause of the poor and the lowly and the disadvantaged would be championed over those who oppressed them.
By studying stories agreed upon to be true, a clearer, albeit hypothesized, portrait of Christ's life can emerge.
Now, let's listen to our third voice, the voice of the Urantia Papers, and what they have to tell us about these early years of Jesus. Have a listen to this.
Paper 128, Jesus' Early Manhood. As Jesus of Nazareth entered upon the early years of his adult life, he had lived and continued to live a normal and average human life on earth. Jesus came into this world just as other children come. He had nothing to do with selecting his parents. He did choose this particular world as the planet whereon to carry out his seventh and final bestowal, his incarnation in the likeness of mortal flesh. But otherwise, he entered the world in a natural manner, growing up as a child of the realm and wrestling with the vicissitudes of his environment, just as do other mortals on this and on similar worlds. Always be mindful of the twofold purpose of Michael's bestowal on Urantia. 1. The mastering of the experience of living the full life of a human creature in mortal flesh, the completion of his sovereignty in Nebadon. 2. The revelation of the universal Father to the mortal dwellers on the worlds of time and space, and the more effective leading of these same mortals to a better understanding of the universal Father. All other creature benefits and universe advantages were incidental and secondary to these major purposes of the mortal bestowal. 1. The 21st year, A.D. 15. With the attainment of adult years, Jesus began in earnest and with full self-consciousness the task of completing the experience of mastering the knowledge of the life of his lowest form of intelligent creatures, thereby finally and fully earning the right of unqualified rulership of his self-created universe. He entered upon this stupendous task, fully realizing his dual nature. But he had already effectively combined these two natures into one, Jesus of Nazareth. Joshua ben Joseph knew full well that he was a man, a mortal man, born of woman. This is shown in the selection of his first title, the Son of Man. He was truly a partaker of flesh and blood, and even now, as he presides in sovereign authority over the destinies of a universe, he still bears among his numerous well-earned titles that of Son of Man. It is literally true that the creative Word, the Creator Son of the Universal Father, was made flesh and dwelt as a man of the realm on Urantia. He labored, grew weary, rested, and slept. He hungered and satisfied such cravings with food. He thirsted and quenched his thirst with water. He experienced the full gamut of human feelings and emotions. He was, in all things, tested, even as you are, and he suffered and died. He obtained knowledge, gained experience,
and combine these into wisdom, just as do other mortals of the realm. Until after his baptism, he availed himself of no supernatural power. He employed no agency not a part of his human endowment as a son of Joseph and Mary. As to the attributes of his pre-human existence, he emptied himself. Prior to the beginning of his public work, his knowledge of men and events was wholly self-limited. He was a true man among men. 2. The 22nd year, A.D. 16. This was one of several years during which Jesus' brothers and sisters were facing the trials and tribulations peculiar to the problems and readjustments of adolescence. Jesus now had brothers and sisters ranging in ages from 7 to 18, and he was kept busy helping them to adjust themselves to the new awakenings of their intellectual and emotional lives. He had thus to grapple with the problems of adolescence as they became manifest in the lives of his younger brothers and sisters. This year, Simon graduated from school and began work with Jesus' old boyhood playmate and ever-ready defender, Jacob, the stonemason. As a result of several family conferences, it was decided that it was unwise for all the boys to take up carpentry. It was thought that by diversifying their trade, they would be prepared to take contracts for putting up entire buildings. Again, they had not all kept busy, since three of them had been working as full-time carpenters. Jesus continued this year at house finishing and cabinet work, but spent most of his time at the caravan repair shop. James was beginning to alternate with him in attendance at the shop. The latter part of this year, when carpenter work was slack about Nazareth, Jesus left James in charge of the repair shop and Joseph at the home bench, while he went over to Sepphoris to work with a smith. He worked 6 months with metals and acquired considerable skill at the anvil. Before taking up his new employment at Sepphoris, Jesus held one of his periodic family conferences and solemnly installed James, then just past 18 years old, as acting head of the family. He promised his brother hearty support and full cooperation and exacted formal promises of obedience to James from each member of the family. From this day, James assumed full financial responsibility for the family, Jesus making his weekly payments to his brother. Never again did Jesus take the reins out of James's hands. While working at Sepphoris, he could have walked home every night if necessary, but he purposely remained away, assigning weather and other reasons, but his true motive was to train James and Joseph in the bearing of the family responsibility. He had begun the slow process of weaning his family. Each Sabbath, Jesus returned to Nazareth, and sometimes during the week when occasion required, to observe the working of the new plan, to give advice, and offer helpful suggestions. 3. The 23rd year, A.D. 17. This year, the financial pressure was slightly relaxed as four were at work. Miriam earned considerable by the sale of milk and butter. Martha had become an expert weaver. The purchase price of the repair shop was over one-third paid. The situation was such that Jesus stopped work for 3 weeks to take Simon to Jerusalem for the Passover, and this was the longest period away from daily toil he had enjoyed since the death of his father. They journeyed to Jerusalem by way of the Decapolis and through Pella, Gerasa, Philadelphia, Heshbon, and Jericho. They returned to Nazareth by the coast route, touching Lydda, Joppa, Caesarea, thence around Mount Carmel to Ptolemais and Nazareth. This trip fairly well acquainted Jesus with the whole of Palestine north of the Jerusalem district. At Philadelphia, Jesus and Simon became acquainted with a merchant from Damascus, who developed such a great liking for the Nazareth couple that he insisted they stop with him at his Jerusalem headquarters. While Simon gave attendance at the temple, Jesus spent much of his time talking with this well-educated and much-traveled man of world affairs. This merchant owned over 4,000 caravan camels. He had interests all over the Roman world and was now on his way to Rome. He proposed that Jesus come to Damascus to enter his Oriental import business, but Jesus explained that he did not feel justified in going so far away from his family just then. But on the way back home, he thought much about these distant cities and the even more remote countries of the far west and the far east. countries he had so frequently heard spoken of by the caravan passengers and conductors. Simon greatly enjoyed his visit to Jerusalem. He was duly received into the Commonwealth of Israel at the Passover consecration of the new Sons of the Commandment. While Simon attended the Passover ceremonies, Jesus mingled with the throngs of visitors and engaged in many interesting personal conferences with numerous Gentile proselytes. Perhaps the most notable of all these contacts was the one with a young Hellenist named Stephen. This young man was on his first visit to Jerusalem and chanced to meet Jesus on Thursday afternoon of Passover week. While they both strolled about viewing the Asmonean Palace, Jesus began the casual conversation that resulted in their becoming interested in each other, and which led to a four-hour discussion of the way of life and the true God and his worship. Stephen was tremendously impressed with what Jesus said. He never forgot his words. And this was the same Stephen who subsequently became a believer in the teachings of Jesus and whose boldness in preaching this early gospel resulted in his being stoned to death by irate Jews. Some of Stephen's extraordinary boldness in proclaiming his view of the new gospel was the direct result of this earlier interview with Jesus. But Stephen never even faintly surmised that the Galilean he had talked with some 15 years previously was the very same person whom he later proclaimed the world's Savior, and for whom he was so soon to die, thus becoming the first martyr of the newly evolving Christian faith. When Stephen yielded up his life as the price of his attack upon the Jewish temple and its traditional practices, there stood by one named Saul, a citizen of Tarsus. And when Saul saw how this Greek could die for his faith, there were aroused in his heart those emotions which eventually led him to espouse the cause for which Stephen died. Later on, he became the aggressive and indomitable Paul, the philosopher, if not the sole founder of the Christian religion. Jesus most cleverly and intentionally contrived to detach various episodes of his life so that they never became, in the eyes of the world, associated together as the doings of a single individual. One purpose which Jesus had in mind when he sought to segregate certain features of his earthly experience was to prevent the building up of such a versatile and spectacular career as would cause subsequent generations to venerate the teacher in place of obeying the truth which he had lived and taught. Jesus did not want to build up such a human record of achievement as would attract attention from his teaching. Very early, he recognized that his followers would be tempted to formulate a religion about him, which might become a competitor of the gospel of the kingdom that he intended to proclaim to the world. Accordingly, he consistently sought to suppress everything during his eventful career, which he thought might be made to serve this natural human tendency to exalt the teacher in place of proclaiming his teachings. This same motive also explains why he permitted himself to be known by different titles during various epochs of his diversified life on earth. Again, he did not want to bring any undue influence to bear upon his family or others, which would lead them to believe in him against their honest convictions. He always refused to take undue or unfair advantage of the human mind. He did not want men to believe in him unless their hearts were responsive to the spiritual realities revealed in his teachings. By the end of this year, the Nazareth home was running fairly smoothly. The children were growing up, and Mary was becoming accustomed to Jesus being away from home. He continued to turn over his earnings to James for the support of the family, retaining only a small portion for his immediate personal expenses. As the years passed, it became more difficult to realize that this man was a son of God on earth. He seemed to become quite like an individual of the realm, just another man among men. And it was ordained by the Father in heaven that the bestowal should unfold in this very way. 5. The 24th year, A.D. 18. This was Jesus' first year of comparative freedom from family responsibility. James was very successful in managing the home with Jesus' help in counsel and finances.
Paper 129. The Later Adult Life of Jesus. Jesus had fully and finally separated himself from the management of the domestic affairs of the Nazareth family and from the immediate direction of its individuals. He continued right up to the event of his baptism to contribute to the family finances and to take a keen personal interest in the spiritual welfare of every one of his brothers and sisters. And always was he ready to do everything humanly possible for the comfort and happiness of his widowed mother. The Son of Man had now made every preparation for detaching himself permanently from the Nazareth home, and this was not easy for him to do. Jesus naturally loved his people. He loved his family, and this natural affection had been tremendously augmented by his extraordinary devotion to them. The more fully we bestow ourselves upon our fellows, the more we come to love them. And since Jesus had given himself so fully to his family, he loved them with a great and fervent affection. All the family had slowly awakened to the realization that Jesus was making ready to leave them. The sadness of the anticipated separation was only tempered by this graduated method of preparing them for the announcement of his intended departure. For more than 4 years, they discerned that he was planning for this eventual separation. 1. The 27th year, A.D. 21. In January of this year, A.D. 21, on a rainy Sunday morning, Jesus took unceremonious leave of his family, only explaining that he was going over to Tiberias and then on a visit to other cities about the Sea of Galilee. And thus he left them, never again to be a regular member of that household. He spent 1 week at Tiberias, the new city which was soon to succeed Sepphoris as the capital of Galilee. And finding little to interest him, he passed on successively through Magdala and Bethsaida to Capernaum, where he stopped to pay a visit to his father's friend Zebedee. Zebedee's sons were fishermen. He himself was a boat builder. Jesus of Nazareth was an expert in both designing and building. He was a master at working with wood, and Zebedee had long known of the skill of the Nazareth craftsmen. For a long time, Zebedee had contemplated making improved boats. He now laid his plans before Jesus and invited the visiting carpenter to join him in the enterprise, and Jesus readily consented. Jesus worked with Zebedee only a little more than 1 year, but during that time he created a new style of boat and established entirely new methods of boat making. By superior technique and greatly improved methods of steaming the boards, Jesus and Zebedee began to build boats of a very superior type, craft which were far more safe for sailing the lake than were the older types. For several years, Zebedee had more work turning out these new style boats than his small establishment could handle. In less than 5 years, practically all the craft on the lake had been built in the shop of Zebedee at Capernaum. Jesus became well known to the Galilean fisher folk as the designer of the new boats. Zebedee was a moderately well-to-do man. His boat building shops were on the lake to the south of Capernaum, and his home was situated down the lake shore near the fishing headquarters of Bethsaida. Jesus lived in the home of Zebedee during the year and more he remained at Capernaum. He had long worked alone in the world, that is, without a father, and greatly enjoyed this period of working with a father partner. Zebedee's wife, Salome, was a relative of Annas, one-time high priest at Jerusalem and still the most influential of the Sadducean group, having been deposed only 8 years previously. Salome became a great admirer of Jesus. She loved him as she loved her own sons, James, John, and David, while her four daughters looked upon Jesus as their elder brother. Jesus often went out fishing with James, John, and David, and they learned that he was an experienced fisherman as well as an expert boat builder. 2. The 28th year, A.D. 22. In March A.D. 22, Jesus took leave of Zebedee and of Capernaum. He asked for a small sum of money to defray his expenses to Jerusalem. While working with Zebedee, he had drawn only small sums of money, which each month he would send to the family at Nazareth. 1 month, Joseph would come down to Capernaum for the money. The next month, Jude would come over to Capernaum, get the money from Jesus, and take it up to Nazareth. Jude's fishing headquarters was only a few miles south of Capernaum. When Jesus took leave of Zebedee's family, he agreed to remain in Jerusalem until Passover time, and they all promised to be present for that event. They even arranged to celebrate the Passover supper together. They all sorrowed when Jesus left them, especially the daughters of Zebedee. Before leaving Capernaum, Jesus had a long talk with his newfound friend and close companion, John Zebedee. He told John that he contemplated traveling extensively until my hour shall come, and asked John to act in his stead in the matter of sending some money to the family at Nazareth each month until the funds due him should be exhausted. And John made him this promise: "My teacher, go about your business, do your work in the world. I will act for you in this or any other matter, and I will watch over your family even as I would foster my own mother and care for my own brothers and sisters. I will disperse your funds, which my father holds, as you have directed, and as they may be needed, and when your money has been expended, if I do not receive more from you, and if your mother is in need, then will I share my own earnings with her. Go your way in peace. I will act in your stead in all these matters." But let us go back to observe Jesus in Jerusalem. For almost 2 months, he spent the greater part of his time listening to the temple discussions with occasional visits to the various schools of the rabbis. Most of the Sabbath days he spent at Bethany. Jesus had carried with him to Jerusalem a letter from Salome, Zebedee's wife, introducing him to the former high priest Annas as one the same as my own son. Annas spent much time with him, personally taking him to visit the many academies of the Jerusalem religious teachers. While Jesus thoroughly inspected these schools and carefully observed their methods of teaching, he never so much as asked a single question in public. Although Annas looked upon Jesus as a great man, he was puzzled as to how to advise him. He recognized the foolishness of suggesting that he enter any of the schools of Jerusalem as a student, and yet he well knew Jesus would never be accorded the status of a regular teacher, inasmuch as he had never been trained in these schools. Presently the time of the Passover drew near, and along with the throngs from every quarter, there arrived at Jerusalem from Capernaum Zebedee and his entire family. They all stopped at the spacious home of Annas, where they celebrated the Passover as one happy family. Before the end of this Passover week, by apparent chance, Jesus met a wealthy traveler and his son, a young man about 17 years of age. These travelers hailed from India, and being on their way to visit Rome and various other points on the Mediterranean, they had arranged to arrive in Jerusalem during the Passover, hoping to find someone whom they could engage as interpreter for both and tutor for the son. The father was insistent that Jesus consent to travel with them. Jesus told him about his family and that it was hardly fair to go away for almost 2 years, during which time they might find themselves in need. Whereupon, this traveler from the Orient proposed to advance to Jesus the wages of 1 year so that he could entrust such funds to his friends for the safeguarding of his family against want. And Jesus agreed to make the trip. 3. The 29th year, A.D. 23. The whole of Jesus' 29th year was spent finishing up the tour of the Mediterranean world. The main events, as far as we have permission to reveal these experiences, constitute the subjects of the narratives which immediately follow this paper. Throughout this tour of the Roman world, for many reasons, Jesus was known as the Damascus Scribe. At Corinth and other stops on the return trip, he was, however, known as the Jewish Tutor. This was an eventful period in Jesus' life. While on this journey, he made many contacts with his fellow men, but this experience is a phase of his life which he never revealed to any member of his family, nor to any of the apostles. Jesus lived out his life in the flesh and departed from this world without anyone, save Zebedee of Bethsaida, knowing that he had made this extensive trip. Some of his friends thought he had returned to Damascus, others thought he had gone to India. His own family inclined to the belief that he was in Alexandria, as they knew that he had once been invited to go there for the purpose of becoming an assistant cousin. When Jesus returned to Palestine, he did nothing to change the opinion of his family that he had gone from Jerusalem to Alexandria. He permitted them to continue in the belief that all the time he had been absent from Palestine had been spent in that city of learning and culture. Only Zebedee, the boat builder of Bethsaida, knew the facts about these matters, and Zebedee told no one. In all your efforts to decipher the meaning of Jesus' life on Urantia, you must be mindful of the motivation of the Michael bestowal. If you would comprehend the meaning of many of his apparently strange doings, you must discern the purpose of his sojourn on your world. He was consistently careful not to build up an over-attractive and attention-consuming personal career. He wanted to make no unusual or overpowering appeals to his fellow men. He was dedicated to the work of revealing the Heavenly Father to his fellow mortals, and at the same time was consecrated to the sublime task of living his mortal earth life, all the while subject to the will of the same Paradise Father. It will also be helpful in understanding Jesus' life on earth if all mortal students of this divine bestowal will remember that while he lived this life of incarnation on Urantia, he lived it for his entire universe. There was something special and inspiring associated with the life he lived in the flesh of mortal nature for every single inhabited sphere throughout all the universe of Nebadon. The same is also true of all those worlds which have become habitable since the eventful times of his sojourn on Urantia. And it will likewise be equally true of all worlds which may become inhabited by will creatures in all the future history of this local universe. The Son of Man, during the time and through the experiences of this tour of the Roman world, practically completed his educational contact training with the diversified peoples of the world of his day and generation. By the time of his return to Nazareth, through the medium of this travel training, he had just about learned how man lived and wrought out his existence on Urantia. The real purpose of his trip around the Mediterranean basin was to know men. He came very close to hundreds of humankind on this journey. He met and loved all manner of men, rich and poor, high and low, black and white, educated and uneducated, cultured and uncultured, animalistic and spiritual, religious and irreligious, moral and immoral. On this Mediterranean journey, Jesus made great advances in his human task of mastering the material and mortal mind, and his indwelling adjuster made great progress in the ascension and spiritual conquest of this same human intellect. By the end of this tour, Jesus virtually knew with all human certainty that he was a Son of God, a Creator Son of the Universal Father. The Adjuster, more and more, was able to bring up in the mind of the Son of Man shadowy memories of his paradise experience in association with his Divine Father ere he ever came to organize and administer this local universe of Nebadon. Thus did the Adjuster, little by little, bring to Jesus' human consciousness those necessary memories of his former and divine existence in the various epochs of the well-nigh eternal past. The last episode of his pre-human experience to be brought forth by the Adjuster was his farewell conference with Emmanuel of Salvington, just before his surrender of conscious personality to embark upon the Urantia incarnation. And this final memory picture of pre-human existence was made clear in Jesus' consciousness on the very day of his baptism by John in the Jordan. 4. The Human Jesus. To the onlooking celestial intelligences of the local universe, this Mediterranean trip was the most enthralling of all Jesus' earth experiences, at least of all his career, right up to the event of his crucifixion and mortal death. This was the fascinating period of his personal ministry, in contrast with the soon following epoch of public ministry. This unique episode was all the more engrossing because he was at this time still the carpenter of Nazareth, the boat builder of Capernaum, the scribe of Damascus. He was still the Son of Man. He had not yet achieved the complete mastery of his human mind. The Adjuster had not fully mastered and counterparted the mortal identity. He was still a man among men. The purely human religious experience, the personal spiritual growth of the Son of Man, well nigh reached the apex of attainment during this, the 29th year. This experience of spiritual development was a consistently gradual growth from the moment of the arrival of his thought adjuster until the day of the completion and confirmation of that natural and normal human relationship between the material mind of man and the mind endowment of the Spirit. The phenomenon of the making of these two minds one, the experience which the Son of Man attained in completion and finality as an incarnated mortal of the realm on the day of his baptism in the Jordan. Throughout these years, while he did not appear to engage in so many seasons of formal communion with his Father in heaven, he perfected increasingly effective methods of personal communication with the indwelling spirit presence of the Paradise Father. He lived a real life, a full life, and a truly normal, natural, and average life in the flesh. He knows from personal experience the equivalent of the actuality of the entire sum and substance of the living of the life of human beings on the material worlds of time and space. The Son of Man experienced those wide ranges of human emotion which reach from superb joy to profound sorrow. He was a child of joy and a being of rare good humor. Likewise was he a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. In a spiritual sense, he did live through the mortal life from the bottom to the top, from the beginning to the end. From a material point of view, he might appear to have escaped living through both social extremes of human existence. But intellectually, he became wholly familiar with the entire and complete experience of humankind. Jesus knows about the thoughts and feelings, the urges and impulses of the evolutionary and descendant mortals of the realms from birth to death. He has lived the human life from the beginnings of physical, intellectual, and spiritual selfhood up through infancy, childhood, youth, and adulthood, even to the human experience of death. He not only passed through these usual and familiar human periods of intellectual and spiritual advancement, but he also fully experienced those higher and more advanced phases of human and adjuster reconciliation which so few Urantia mortals ever attain. And thus he experienced the full life of mortal man, not only as it is lived on your world, but also as it is lived on all other evolutionary worlds of time and space, even on the highest and most advanced of all the worlds settled in light and life. Although this perfect life which he lived in the likeness of mortal flesh may not have received the unqualified and universal approval of his fellow mortals, those who chanced to be his contemporaries on earth, still the life which Jesus of Nazareth lived in the flesh and on Urantia did receive full and unqualified acceptance by the Universal Father as constituting at one and the same time and in one and the same personality life the fullness of the revelation of the eternal God to mortal man, and the presentation of perfected human personality to the satisfaction of the infinite Creator. And this was his true and supreme purpose. He did not come down to live on Urantia as the perfect and detailed example for any child or adult, any man or woman in that age or any other. True it is indeed that in his full, rich, beautiful, and noble life, we may all find much that is exquisitely exemplary, divinely inspiring. But this is because he lived a true and genuinely human life. Jesus did not live his life on earth in order to set an example for all other human beings to copy. He lived this life in the flesh by the same mercy ministry that you all may live your lives on earth. And as he lived his mortal life in his day, and as he was, so did he thereby set the example for all of us, thus to live our lives in our day, and as we are. You may not aspire to live his life, but you can resolve to live your lives, even as and by the same means that he lived his. Jesus may not be the technical and detailed example for all the mortals of all ages on all the realms of this local universe, but he is everlastingly the inspiration and guide of all paradise pilgrims from the worlds of initial ascension up through a universe of universes and on through Havona to paradise. Jesus is the new and living way from man to God, from the partial to the perfect, from the earthly to the heavenly, from time to eternity. By the end of the 29th year, Jesus of Nazareth had virtually finished the living of the life required of mortals as sojourners in the flesh. He came on earth, the fullness of God to be manifest to man. He had now become well nigh the perfection of man, awaiting the occasion to become manifest to God. And he did all of this before he was 30 years of age.
In our last episode, we talked about the theories and the ideas about the idea. If Jesus traveled, where would he go? And we had some theories about India, Tibet. We had some theories about England, or perhaps in and around the Dead Sea. But most scholars have pretty much rejected those ideas. Another idea that comes from the Urantia Papers is the idea that Jesus traveled to Rome. Now, if we were a young man in and around Judea at around that time, what is more likely? That we would travel to a country where we don't speak the language, a culture that's 3,000 miles away, completely foreign? Or would we at least glance in the direction of Rome? The story of ancient Rome is a familiar one. The dynamic republic that was transformed into the greatest empire the world has ever known. What was it that made it so different from the civilizations that had gone before it? One clue lies in the word civilization itself. It comes from a Latin word that means citizen, the importance of the citizen. And this laid the foundation for the whole of the Western civilization's growth and development ever since. What Rome managed to achieve had never been done before. It created a civilization for export, franchise by franchise. Civilization is so much more than just culture. Culture is an immensely exportable item, as we see the American movie industry. Alexander the Great had done this for the whole of the Mediterranean basin and the Middle East. Rome, in fact, made its own culture from the conquered culture of the Greeks. This freed the Romans to concentrate on something much more important than art, beauty, sculpture, philosophy. Politics. Civilization's dark art. The Romans developed an exportable infrastructure that civilization could rest upon, such as the Senate, the law courts, so-called justice system. They developed durable systems and institutions through the pragmatic approach as they went along, free from the clutter of dogma and ideology. There were no philosopher kings who created this political machine. It was hammered out and improvised along the way, often through the blind panic as the elite desperately clung on to power, while the masses, poor and poverty-stricken, seethed with anger and anxiety. And at the same time, external enemies menaced from both sides, from all sides, from every side. But Rome's response to these crises was totally unfamiliar. Rome didn't merely conquer the world. It transformed the world into Rome. They made their enemies an offer they could not refuse. The chance to become Roman. And this turned out to be the key to the genius of the Roman political military machine. In many cases, the ancient Roman political machine was a protection racket. Join us and we will protect you. You will become Roman. Defy us and we will bury you. Pay us taxes and we will continue to protect you. Disturb the peace and we will crucify you. As each people were conquered, they would become a clan protectorate of the protector Rome, if they went quietly. Their citizens would become Roman citizens with certain rights, and their country would become a client protectorate of Rome. They would pay taxes to a franchise owner, a client governor, or a client king, as we saw with King Herod of Judea. The institutions of the client province would become the Roman institutions of that area. As a result, more and more of the Middle East would begin to become more Roman in political institution and organization, and Greek in culture and language. By this method, Rome became the most powerful civilization on earth, and it would not be equaled until the 20th century, 2,000 years later. So, is it any wonder why a young man growing up in Judea would look to Rome when the wanderlust and the excitement of travel came upon him. So here we have a bit of information about why Jesus might go to Rome. And then my friend Watson has prepared a brief synoptic of paper 130 of the Urantia book and will give us a brief view of the trip to Rome as outlined in that book. And we will follow it up with some selected paragraphs and discourses by Jesus on his way to Rome. And again in our next episode, with Jesus in Rome and returning to Judea. So let's have a listen.
By the time of Jesus, the Romans controlled much of Europe and the Mediterranean. Rome built its empire through alliances, treaties, and military conquests. And until the empire began to collapse around 400 AD, its provinces and territories contributed heavily to the wealth and status of the city of Rome.
Two thousand years ago, one civilization held the entire Western world in its grasp. From Northern Europe to Africa and the Middle East, it imposed laws, ideas, and a single language. For two millennia, we've dreamed of its cities and its triumphs, its idealism and its decadence. Rome, the power and the glory. Savagery was matched by its size. When the Colosseum was built, Rome was a city of a million people and growing. Not until London of the 19th century would a city approach this size again.
What I think you'd notice if a time traveler went back would be the smell, the noise, the dirt, the crowdedness. I think there'll be lots of beggars, lots of signs of sickness, disease, lots of small children. It'll be rather like Calcutta or Rio, crowded modern town, very poor, with these monumental buildings in the center expressing the wealth and power of the empire.
Traffic was terrible. Julius Caesar forbade wheeled traffic during the day so people could move around, which meant that at night all these carts started going on these stone streets, and it was so noisy that you couldn't sleep.
To manage the problems of organizing such a huge concentration of people, the Romans invented the science of urban planning. They invented cement, built gigantic public storehouses, and installed citywide sewage systems. But their greatest achievement was the water supply.
The aqueducts of Rome reached 60 and 70 miles into the hills to guarantee a continual flow of fresh water into the city. That flow of fresh water provided enough water, gallons per person per day, that was not equaled by the city of Rome until the 1950s.
Along with millions of gallons of water, Romans consumed a staggering 8,000 tons of grain weekly. Supertankers, each carrying 1,000 tons of grain, crisscrossed the Mediterranean. They were the largest ships built until the Atlantic steamers of the 19th century. The city of Rome was the heart of an empire that stretched from Scotland to Syria. Never has the Western world been better organized or more united. In the year 100 AD, you could travel from Egypt to France on paved roads with only one currency and one passport in your pocket. And this vast, well-organized empire would muster the largest army the world had ever seen. Over 500,000 soldiers. Rome was the superpower of the ancient world.
All of the text of this fifth epical revelation of truth, the Urantia book, is in the public domain. Thus you may freely share this with others. Paper 130, On the Way to Rome. The tour of the Roman world consumed most of the 28th and the entire 29th year of Jesus' life on earth. Jesus and the two natives from India, Gonad and his son Gainad, left Jerusalem on a Sunday morning, April 26, AD 22. They made their journey according to schedule, and Jesus said goodbye to the father and son in the city of Charax on the Persian Gulf on the 10th day of December the following year, AD 23. Section 1, at Joppa, Jesus' Discourse on Jonah. During their stay in Joppa, Jesus met Gadiah, a Philistine interpreter who worked for one Simon, a tanner. Jesus' last visit with Gadiah had to do with a discussion of good and evil. Jesus said, "My brother, God is love, therefore he must be good, and his goodness is so great and real that it cannot contain the small and unreal things of evil. God is so positively good that there is absolutely no place in him for negative evil. Evil is the immature choosing and the unthinking misstep of those who are resistant to goodness, rejectful of beauty, and disloyal to truth. Evil is only the misadaptation of immaturity or the disruptive and distorting influence of ignorance. Evil is the inevitable darkness which falls upon the heels of the unwise rejection of light. Evil is that which is dark and untrue, and which, when consciously embraced and willfully endorsed, becomes sin. Your Father in heaven, by endowing you with the power to choose between truth and error, created the potential negative of the positive way of light and life. But such errors of evil are really non-existent until such a time as an intelligent creature wills their existence by mischoosing the way of life. And then are such evils later exalted into sin by the knowing and deliberate choice of such a willful and rebellious creature. This is why our Father in heaven permits the good and the evil to go along together until the end of life, just as nature allows the wheat and the tares to grow side by side until the harvest." Gadiah was fully satisfied with Jesus' answer to his question and his subsequent discussion, which made clear to his mind the real meaning of these momentous statements. Section 2, at Caesarea. Jesus gave personal spiritual advice to many individuals he met. Here are a few brief highlights. Gainad was, by this time, beginning to learn how his tutor, as Jesus, spent his leisure in his unusual personal ministry to his fellow men. And the young Indian set about to find out the motive of these incessant activities. He asked, "Why do you occupy yourself so continuously with these visits with strangers?" And Jesus answered, "Gainad, no man is a stranger to one who knows God. In the experience of finding the Father in heaven, you discover that all men are your brothers. And does it seem strange that one should enjoy the exhilaration of meeting a newly discovered brother? To become acquainted with one's brothers and sisters, to know their problems, and to learn to love them is the supreme experience of living." Section 3, at Alexandria, that's in Egypt, AD 22. Gainad said to Jesus, "Teacher Joshua, you know more than these professors. You should stand up and tell them the great things you have told me. They are befogged by much thinking. I shall speak to my Father and have him arrange it." Jesus smiled, saying, "You are an admiring pupil, but These teachers are not minded that you and I should instruct them. The pride of unspiritualized learning is a treacherous thing in human experience. The true teacher maintains his intellectual integrity by ever remaining a learner. Section 4, Jesus' Discourse and Reality, and here again brief selections only. The source of universe reality is the infinite. The material things of finite creation are the time-space repercussions of the paradise pattern and the universal mind of the eternal God. Only in the perfection, harmony, and unanimity of will can the creature become as one with the Creator. And such a state of divinity is attained and maintained only by the creature's continuing to live in time and eternity by consistently conforming his finite personal will to the divine will of the Creator. Always must the desire to do the Father's will be supreme in the soul and dominant over the mind of an ascending Son of God. Jesus states, mindless causation cannot evolve the refined and complex from the crude and the simple. Neither can spiritless experience evolve the divine characters of eternal survival from the material minds of the mortals of time. The one attribute of the universe which so exclusively characterizes the infinite deity is this unending creative bestowal of personality which can survive in progressive deity attainment. Personality is that cosmic endowment, that phase of universal reality, which can coexist with unlimited change and at the same time retain its identity in the very presence of all such changes and forever afterwards. The meaning of life is its adaptability. The value of life is its progressibility, even to the heights of God consciousness. Knowledge is a sphere of the material or fact-discerning mind. Truth is the domain of the spiritually endowed intellect that is conscious of knowing God. Knowledge is demonstrable. Truth is experienced. Knowledge is a possession of the mind. Truth an experience of the soul, the progressing self. Knowledge is a function of the non-spiritual level. Truth is a phase of the mind-spirit level of the universes. The eye of the material mind perceives a world of factual knowledge. The eye of the spiritualized intellect discerns a world of true values. These two views, synchronized and harmonized, reveal the world of reality, wherein wisdom interprets the phenomena of the universe in terms of progressive personal experience. Section 7, at Carthage, Discourse on Time and Space. And that is very profound and is best understood when perused in full.
Paper 130. On the Way to Rome. The tour of the Roman world consumed most of the 28th and the entire 29th year of Jesus' life on earth. Jesus and the two natives from India, Gonad and his son Gainid, left Jerusalem on a Sunday morning, April 26, A.D. 22. They made their journey according to schedule, and Jesus said goodbye to the father and son in the city of Charax on the Persian Gulf, on the 10th day of December the following year, A.D. 23. From Jerusalem they went to Caesarea by way of Joppa. At Caesarea they took a boat for Alexandria. From Alexandria they sailed for Lycia in Crete. From Crete they sailed for Carthage, touching at Cyrene. At Carthage they took a boat for Naples, stopping at Malta, Syracuse, and Messina. From Naples they went to Capua, whence they traveled by the Appian Way to Rome. After their stay in Rome, they went overland to Tarentum, where they set sail for Athens in Greece, stopping at Nicopolis and Corinth. From Athens, they went to Ephesus by way of Troas. From Ephesus, they sailed for Cyprus, putting in at Rhodes on the way. They spent considerable time visiting and resting on Cyprus, and then sailed for Antioch in Syria. From Antioch, they journeyed south to Sidon, and then went over to Damascus. From there, they traveled by caravan to Mesopotamia, passing through Thapsacus and Larissa. They spent some time in Babylon, visited Ur and other places, and then went to Susa. From Susa they journeyed to Charax, from which place Gonad and Gainid embarked for India. It was while working 4 months at Damascus that Jesus had picked up the rudiments of the language spoken by Gonad and Gainid. While there, he had labored much of the time on translations from Greek into one of the languages of India, being assisted by a native of Donad's home district. On this Mediterranean tour, Jesus spent about half of each day teaching Gaenad and acting as interpreter during Gonad's business conferences and social contacts. The remainder of each day, which was at his disposal, he devoted to making those close personal contacts with his fellow men, those intimate associations with the mortals of the realm, which so characterized his activities during these years that just preceded his public ministry. From first-hand observation and actual contact, Jesus acquainted himself with the higher material and intellectual civilization of the Occident and the Levant. From Gonad and his brilliant son, he learned a great deal about the civilization and culture of India and China, for Gonad, himself a citizen of India, had made 3 extensive trips to the Empire of the Yellow Race. Gaenad, the young man, learned much from Jesus during this long and intimate association. They developed a great affection for each other, and the lad's father many times tried to persuade Jesus to return with them to India, but Jesus always declined, pleading the necessity for returning to his family in Palestine. 1. At Joppa, Discourse on Jonah. During their stay in Joppa, Jesus met Gadiah, a Philistine interpreter who worked for one Simon, a tanner. Gonad's agents in Mesopotamia had transacted much business with this Simon, so Gonad and his son desired to pay him a visit on their way to Caesarea. While they tarried at Joppa, Jesus and Gadiah became warm friends. This young Philistine was a truth-seeker. Jesus was a truth-giver. He was the truth for that generation on Urantia. When a great truth-seeker and a great truth-giver meet, the result is a great and liberating enlightenment born of the experience of new truth. One day after the evening meal, Jesus and the young Philistine strolled down by the sea, and Gadiah, not knowing that this scribe of Damascus was so well versed in the Hebrew traditions, pointed out to Jesus the ship landing from which it was reputed that Jonah had embarked on his ill-fated voyage to Tarshish. And when he had concluded his remarks, he asked Jesus this question: "But do you suppose the big fish really did swallow Jonah?" Jesus perceived that this young man's life had been tremendously influenced by this tradition, and that its contemplation had impressed upon him the folly of trying to run away from duty. Jesus therefore said nothing that would suddenly destroy the foundations of Gadiah's present motivation for practical living. In answering this question, Jesus said, "My friend, we are all Jonahs with lives to live in accordance with the will of God, and at all times when we seek to escape the present duty of living, by running away to far-off enticements, we thereby put ourselves in the immediate control of those influences which are not direct powers of truth and the forces of righteousness. The flight from duty is the sacrifice of truth. The escape from the service of light and life can only result in those distressing conflicts with the difficult wails of selfishness, which lead eventually to darkness and death, unless such God-forsaking Jonahs shall turn their hearts, even when in the very depths of despair, to seek after God and His goodness. And when such disheartened souls sincerely seek for God, hunger for truth and thirst for righteousness, there is nothing that can hold them in further captivity. No matter into what great depths they may have fallen, when they seek the light with a whole heart, the Spirit of the Lord God of heaven will deliver them from their captivity. The evil circumstances of life will spew them out upon the dry land of fresh opportunities for renewed service and wiser living." Gadiah was mightily moved by Jesus' teaching, and they talked long into the night by the seaside, and before they went to their lodgings, they prayed together and for each other. This was the same Gadiah who listened to the later preaching of Peter, became a profound believer in Jesus of Nazareth, and held a memorable argument with Peter one evening at the home of Dorcas. And Gadiah had very much to do with the final decision of Simon, the wealthy leather merchant, to embrace Christianity. In this narrative of the personal work of Jesus with his fellow mortals on this tour of the Mediterranean, we shall, in accordance with our permission, freely translate his words into modern phraseology current on Urantia at the time of this presentation. Jesus' last visit with Gadiah had to do with a discussion of good and evil. This young Philistine was much troubled by a feeling of injustice because of the presence of evil in the world alongside the good. He said, "How can God, if He is infinitely good, permit us to suffer the sorrows of evil? After all, who creates evil?" It was still believed by many in those days that God creates both good and evil, but Jesus never taught such error. In answering this question, Jesus said, "My brother, God is love, therefore he must be good, and his goodness is so great and real that it cannot contain the small and unreal things of evil. God is so positively good that there is absolutely no place in him for negative evil. Evil is the immature choosing and the unthinking misstep of those who are resistant to goodness, rejectful of beauty, and disloyal to truth. Evil is only the misadaptation of immaturity or the disruptive and distorting influence of ignorance, the inevitable darkness which follows upon the heels of the unwise rejection of light. Evil is that which is dark and untrue, and which, when consciously embraced and willfully endorsed, becomes sin. Your Father in heaven, by endowing you with the power to choose between truth and error, created the potential negative of the positive way of light and life. But such errors of evil are really non-existent until such a time as an intelligent creature wills their existence by mischoosing the way of life. And then are such evils later exalted into sin by the knowing and deliberate choice of such a willful and rebellious creature. This is why our Father in heaven permits the good and the evil to go along together until the end of life, just as nature allows the wheat and the tares to grow side by side until the harvest." Gadaya was fully satisfied with Jesus' answer to his question after their subsequent discussion had made clear to his mind the real meaning of these momentous statements.
Please join us in our next episode as we go to Rome with Jesus and we hear the discourses of this tutor instructing this young man on the principles of life and the spiritual journey. Please tell your friends about this program. Invite them to join us. Pass some of this information along to them, and we'll see you in our next episode in Rome.